This is Ron Pinder, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 7th of July 2012.
Ronald Pinder, Catford, born Catford, London, South London, 1932, 30th of June.
Would you say your father was an educated man?
Never knew anything about him.
You never knew about him?
No, nothing at all.
Right. In fact, because you were a foster child, weren't you, with them? Barnardo's?
The position was that I was born in South London. My mother, I lived with my mother and her parents for 2 years. She got the TB and she died. And the parents, grandparents couldn't look after me. So then I went into Barnardo's. That was in 1933, 34. And then I went to a foster home in Kent, which, that was fine, it was great. But unfortunately, when I got there, there was the foster mother, foster father, granddad lived next door, and a foster brother. 6 years later, there was just the foster mother and I. There's the war, and the others just passed away very early, and, you know, life was a bit traumatic in a way, I suppose. Though I did, I had in many ways, I suppose, an ideal childhood because I, you know, had to roam the countryside in Kent, and of course, being of that age during the war, you didn't worry about, you just watched the Battle of Britain and things without
in the sky, yeah.
Sky without worrying about it. We weren't that far from Westmorland. So,
Do you have memories of the Barnardo's home?
No. I was in what they called the Baby's Castle in Hawkhurst in Kent. And my foster mother went there and sort of picked me out and took me away. I was only 18 months, 2 years old at that stage.
What kind of schooling did you have, Ron? Were you good at school?
No, not particularly. It was a Church of England school. You all went and you left at 14. When I was coming up to 14, my foster mother said, "Well, don't bother too much with the exams because even if you pass to go to grammar school, there is no way I can afford to take you to pay for you to go." So. That was it. I was evacuated for 6 months down to Somerset, and school in there was, we were sort of 3 miles from the school, and you soon realised that nobody really knew who you were, where you were, so you didn't bother to go to school. Go and tickle the trout in the local streams instead. So schooling was a bit... the last year was... we had an ex-army teacher come in, and he soon sussed me out because he said, "I'd done something wrong." So I said, "Oh, well, that's the stick again." He said, "No, it's not." I said, "Oh, not the stick?" He said, "No." He said, "You'll be confined to the classroom this afternoon." I said, "Oh, we've got a football match." He said, "You'll miss that, won't you?" And he soon sussed out that there were other ways to punish a child than hitting them, you know, and punishment didn't last. Didn't make any difference because you got so used to it, the slipper and the stick. And that, but I was far more devastated not being able to play cricket or football or, you know, or any other sport that happened to be about.
So when you left school, were you 14?
No, I stayed on for a bit longer, and I was actually 15 when I left.
But no qualifications?
No qualifications at all.
So what on earth did he do, Ron?
Barnardo's decided that, for some reason, that they would not allow me to stay with my foster mother. She was upset. So they found me a job as an apprentice shipwright in a company, the New Medway Steam Packet Company in Rochester. So I went to live in Diggs. I think I got paid 22 shillings and ninepence a week or something. But I got paid extra because I used to cycle to work. It was interesting, but I soon decided, you know, I soon discovered I wasn't really cut out for this, you know, carpentry business. It was interesting. We had ships like the Medway Queen, Queen of Kent, the Royal Daffodil, which had been to Dunkirk and, you know, places like that. So then I tried to find a way out, and I decided to join the IRF, try and join the IRF as a boy entrant, which I did when I joined up. I think I was at 15 and... when did it join up? 10th of the 2nd, 1948. So, funny you remember these dates. Mm. So I was, 15 and about 8 months. And I signed on for 8 years from when I was 18. And I took up training as a telegraphist. I went to RAF Compton Bassett, did some square bashing there, and then, went to RAF Locking, actually, in Somerset, and then ended up at Compton Bassett in Wiltshire. I was in the third entry after the war. We had a bit of a ding-dong, because it was great fun going into other people's billets and turning all the beds over and what have you. And then amongst one of these melees, I broke my ankle. And that was very good, because they sent me off to hospital. I then went to a rehabilitation place at RAF Chessington. And it was quite strange, because I was with people, pilots and people from the war and what have you, and there was an organisation called Lest We Forget, run by mainly females, and they used to get tickets for all the shows in London, and of course they used to come round and pat me on the head and say, you look very young to have been in the war. then of course once that was over, I had to go back to Compton Bassett to the reality of the RAF.
But they sent you abroad, didn't they, the RAF, to the continent?
Yes, I went to Germany in 1950. Spent 2.5 years in Germany. Came back to England and did what we call... I was on special sort of signals duties there. And came back to England, did normal station signals, and... I suddenly got I was in charge of a sort of a signals unit, and I suddenly got a message through to report to RAF Withall in Birmingham. And I saw this chap who I'd met before. He was, I think he was Ceylonese, but he was a civilian, and he held the rank of squadron leader. And he said, come in, sit down, how would you like to go to Warsaw? And of course, I thought, Warsaw? Warsaw? He said, Warsaw, Poland. So I said, oh, yes. So we had a discussion and off, and then I went back to, I went to RAF Ryslip, and from there I was sort of into London to what they called the Air Foreign Liaison Office, which was right opposite the Houses of Parliament on the corner of Parliament Square, and... eventually, I landed up in the British Embassy in Poland, in Warsaw. I must have been the highest paid corporal in the RAF. I had a maid, a flat of my own, chauffeur driven to work. I had my own room in the embassy, which nobody else came in. But it was, yes, it was interesting.
Were you living in the lap of luxury in a war-torn country? Was it rubble all around?
There was rubble, yes, there was rubble all around. I mean, it was the same as in Germany. I mean, we went to Hamburg and Essen and places like that. I mean, yes, it, devastation all around. In Poland, they had a big clear up, but it was still, you know, there were areas which were still very, unbuilt. You know, what they used to do was they'd have a wall and they'd paint it, just paint the wall. And of course, when you went round the other side, there wasn't anything. You know?
What were your duties then in the Polish embassy as an RAF officer? Were you flying?
No. I was a corporal still.
Right.
And, nobody else knew what I did. The air attaché, who was a group captain, was never came into my room. He wasn't allowed in. It's all right now, but I was what I suppose you would call a listening spy. In those days, when we were in Germany, for example, we were on this little camp and we all arrived there and there's these massive aerials and everything. And I'll tell you a little story about it. One of the lads, in the evenings, I used to go down to the canteen and grab a beer and have a little break. Well, one of the lads came back and he been taking quite a while. And he said, this secrecy business, he said, when I got down there, I got to the bar, and you know little Annie behind the bar, she said, Mr. Burley, do not a thrush. The Germans and the Russians will still be sending their Morse, and you will still be able to listen to it when you get back upstairs. And in many ways, the embassy was very similar. When I arrived there, I sort of got everything in, and lack of signals and what have you. And I thought, oh, dear. So I said to the air attaché, got a problem here with the signals. He said, well, there's only one person. You'll have to fix it. I said, but I was down as a civilian, administration. So to cut a long story short, I had a word with the diplomatic wireless lads, and they said, no, that's your job. So I had to go up on the roof and rig all these aerials back up, which had blown down. And you get up on the roof and there's East Germans there over that side and the Czechs and all the others. And the Polish chap in the box taking photographs of you, you know. So they knew more or less what you were up to.
Did you speak Polish?
No. That always puzzled me because I would have thought they would have got a Polish speaking. But I think perhaps one of the reasons were that if anything happened, you know, you wouldn't be able to tell them anything anyway.
What's your first recollection of being aware that there was a place called the Antarctic? Did you read books, see films?
No. Oh, yes, I was aware of the Antarctic. It never occurred to me until I'd come back to England. I'd worked in the Ministry of London, got demobbed, and then I was working for British European Airways at London Airport. And that was a pretty boring job. And I knew the chap who worked at W.H. Smith, so I used to get a pile of magazines and sit there, and, you know, because I had nothing to do, virtually. And I was going flipping through these, and it said, wanted, radio mechanics, Falkland Island Dependencies Survey, 18-month tour. And I thought, well, that sounds better than this. So I applied for it, and it wasn't... I knew where the Antarctic was, and I knew where the Falklands were. And then I turned up at the Crown Agents in London and saw a chap called Bill Sloman and Vivian Fuchs, Bunny Fuchs, and his wife, Eleanor, and Anne Todd.
Who I gather is here today.
Pardon? Yes. And I think there were two others, and that was it. And that was the headquarters.
This was 1959, wasn't it?
Yes.
So you had an interview?
Yes.
How was it?
Oh, no problem. I just went in and they said, can you do this, can you do that? Would you mind cooking for, you know, the other chaps when you're down there? I said, well, you know, I'm a bit limited, but if they put up with it, I'll put up with theirs. And that was virtually it. And then we went on board the ship.
And the radio experience of being gathered in the RAF.
Yes.
Was it sufficient radio experience?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah, because we used to communicate all over the world in those days. Christmas Island, well, you name it, you know. Anywhere, yes, it was the ideal thing, really. And so then...
So then you caught the Shackleton.
Caught the Shackleton, Captain Blackburn, and his young wife, which we had was a bit amusing. We read about her in the Southampton Gazette.
Oh, yeah.
When the lads bought this and said, Captain Blackburn and his young bride. She wasn't exactly young. And he, being a naval chap, had us holy stoning decks and cleaning brasses and keeping us, you know, sort of entertained all the way down. And then we went down into the Falklands, and of course that's where the office was. And on the way, I had my RAF uniform, which you had to keep for, you know, reserve. We stopped off. Oh, I think something in the islands. I can't think of the RAF. Oh.
The Azores?
No.
Cape Verde, Tristan da Cunha?
Cape Verde, no, wait a minute. What's the thing of it?
Don't worry.
Yeah. Anyway, this bumboat used to come up and flog, you know, all sorts of things. So I sold my uniform for a bunch of bananas and a guitar.
Your army uniform?
My RAF uniform, yes. Yeah. Complete with stripes and...
You clearly weren't planning to go back to...
I wasn't going back.
Okay. You were at Signy for... Was it two seasons, 59 to 61?
Three seasons.
Three seasons.
Yes, three seasons. I never went anywhere else.
Right.
I went into Signy in October, November 59, and I came out 62, was it? 61, 62, in April. That's the only place I ever went, because I'd got interested in, the wildlife, and I did some work on the... Cape pigeons. So
was that off your own bat, Ron, or was that something you'd arranged beforehand?
No, it was off my own bat. What happened was, in those days, most of the scientists and biologists used to go in under the guise of met men. Hmm. And like Lance Tickell, I mean, he was basically a met man, and he did all his research under the guise, you know, and that's what they did. Well, when I got there, Pete Richards was in charge of the birding programme, and I helped him. And then when he left, I carried on. And then Fergus O'Gorman. He was Dick Laws was the first biologist. That was primarily, that's all he was employed for. And that was years before. And Fergus, I think, must have been the next one. He wanted help with the bird banding and that, and I sort of ended up taking it over. And then I used to go and visit the nests and mark the birds and generally do observations on them, which, all I was doing really was preparing it for somebody else. Like, you marked all the skuas' nest and you rang the adults so that anybody coming in wanted to work on them had got instant
data. Yeah. So had you got an interest in ornithology before you went south?
No, not really, no.
So it was just pure random, was it?
Yes. And we used to tag the seals as well. And then I sort of left it. And it wasn't until I came back, and could Martin Holgate, he came down in the summer and bought that's when the actual biological unit was set up, and he came down, and when I got back to England, he nobbled me and said, look, you've done all this data, you might as well write it all up. So I spent a couple of months at Queen Mary College in London writing it all up.
How was that for a chap with
few qualifications, academic qualifications.
Well, you know, that was quite good, actually. Mm. And I did try and get a job with the National Trust and that, but the problem then, they just started doing graduates only. So I dipped out. A fellow called Harry Dolman, who was at Bird Island before me, at Sydney and Bird Island before me, he I think, was one of the last non-graduates that they employed. So, and then, of course, I got married. And when one gets married, one has to get a job and one has to work. So that sort of really went out on us. I mean, the rest of the time I've just been working, doing normal work, you know.
Such as?
Well, I worked, when I came back, I got a job. I worked with the police for 2 years. That was very interesting, but very poorly paid. And I realised that I couldn't survive on that, not bring up a family. So then I applied for a job with the what was then the Central Electricity Generating Board. They had a control centre in the middle of London. And I got a post there. The idea was that we'd have to move back to London. But because it was 12-hour shifts, so you work 3 days 1 week and four the next, and we had a little room we could stay over, I've discovered that there was really no need to leave, to sort of move to the city, which I didn't really want to do anyway. I preferred to live in the country. So I stayed put, and there I stayed for 22 years.
Let's focus on your time in the Antarctic. Yeah. You, as I mentioned, you went to Sydney as a radio operator in 59. Mm-hmm. Sydney was a bit overwhelmed with people that year, wasn't it, because of complications elsewhere?
Well, yes, when we got there, there was, I think there were five of us due for the winter. And then when the last ship came in, it had been down to the Danco Basin on the Danco coast, and they couldn't get in. So we had an extra four people. And the dogs. When I was at Sydney, when I arrived at Sydney, there were just two dogs, so they were more or less pets, although they were kept chained up there, and, you know, there was pets and they got taken for walks and things. But then we had, I think we ended up with 18, 20 dogs. And so, of course, we had two sledging teams, which, you know, was a bit of an eye-opener. So they had to be looked after. Yeah, it was all right, but it was, you know, there's always things to do.
Where did you all sleep, I thought, if you were...
There was a bunk. There was enough room in the bunks, bunk beds. So it used to get down, I think, -6 in the bedroom.
Apart from doing your radio work, communication, sending signals back to Stanley, I guess you were sending all the Met Office signals.
Yeah, to Port Stanley and the, the... personal signals once a month, 200 words a month to Port Stanley.
Were you also in touch with ships at all?
Yes, we used to be in touch with the ships when they came down. We had what was called the Goon Show, which was a sort of 7 o'clock to 8 or 9 o'clock at night.
And that was voice, was it, rather than
that, voice? Yes, that was mainly voice. And also... we used to talk to the other bases in the evenings and that. And, I mean, we did... there was a bit of ham radio as well. I didn't get too involved in that because I felt it was a bit antisocial. Because when you were on the radio in the radio cabin, you could hear the crackling in the lounge and anybody trying to listen to Port Stanley. So I didn't bother too much with that. Although I did have a regular... contact with a chap in Wales who used to pass messages to parents and people like that.
Tell me how things changed over those 3 years you were at Sydney, because at that time British Antarctic Survey was gradually trying to improve its facilities, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Well, the first year, I say, we... was normal, and we used to work. It was very much traditional. You had the the cook of the week, who was expected to provide three meals a day and cookies in the afternoon. And I must admit, it was a bit of a chore.
You changed that, didn't you?
Yes. Yeah, that was the second year when Wink came down.
Wink Mander
and Derek Clark. Well, they'd already been through all that and said, well, you know, we didn't like it, do you? And we said no. So then we did Down Day About. And we carried that on. And then the big change came my last summer, when Martin Holgate came in with Barry Haywood, Pete Tilbrook, and they were starting the proper biological programme. Prior to that, we were on the engines only went on really for the skeds in the mornings and the evenings, and but they needed 24-hour power, which sort of upset the diesel mech a bit, but it was quite strange actually. We used to wind Martin up occasionally, and
how do you mean?
Oh well, we used to say, "Oh bloody scientists, you know, too many chiefs, not enough bloody Indians. How are you going to get everything done?" You know.
But did the whole feel of the base change when the scientists started to arrive?
Not really, no. No, because we all got on together. But it was just, yeah, I suppose there was a feeling that things weren't going to be the same ever again. I think basically it, you know, you just fitted in and did what you had to do. I was fairly fortunate because when he came in, we had a new radio operator in, Pete Hobbs. And he was a big ham radio man and dead keen on radio. And I thought, well, I'd have to sort of go with him and do Down Day About or something like that. And I'd have to fit the birds and things in when I could. But he was quite happy to do the whole lot. In fact, he moved his bed into the radio shack. So I just got on with, you know, all the bird programmes and things like that.
So that occupied an increasing amount of your time?
Yes.
So what were you discovering about the Cape pigeons that either you didn't know or wasn't widely known previously?
Well we found out that they used to migrate to New Zealand, and the New Zealand ones used to come back to us, and we started getting age-old birds. We found out when, you know, the age that they started to breed, because they'd, and things like that, and the length of, I think most of the incubation period, things like that, they knew about, but they didn't know where they went to, you know, during the winter. We started, you know, finding out things like that. But as I say, my main idea was to prepare the ground for somebody else more qualified than I was to do all the hard work.
Do you know if anybody ever did that?
No, because when I produced the paper, that was told them more or less, I think, what they wanted, so they could specialise. Right. They would take the feeding habits and go around with buckets and collect the feed and diagnose, you know, digest that. And
so were they? Are they an interesting species? Or
no, they're fairly straightforward, actually. No, no, they're not very complicated like the albatrosses and the giant petrels, who have a much go further afield. But,
were you able to use the dog teams at all? Was there much sledging around Sydney?
Yes. We had good years and bad years, sea ice. We sent them all over to Coronation Island the first winter. The second winter we sent them over to Coronation Island, and the sea ice conveniently went out. This was when I think Roger Filer, Paddy White, and Bernard Harrison went over, and Wink, Derek Clark, and I were left on base. And they they were over the other side, and they went up to the highest point that they could get, and we went to ours, and we made signals to one another, and we tried semaphore, but that wasn't getting anywhere. and we couldn't really out. They could hear us at one stage. The radio, that was a hand crank thing, broke down. And we didn't really have any contact. So we decided that we'd got to get a boat over to get them and the dogs back.
Mm.
And it required two people to go in the boats. So Wink said, well, I'm buggered if I'm letting you go, you and Clarkie go over there, and I'm stuck here if the weather's bad. So we had to wait until it was a really calm day. And we took two boats over, a clinker and a 12-foot clinker and the fiberglass, and we'd rigged it all out with ropes and chains and what have you. And we went over and we brought the dogs back, and then we went back over and got the lads back, and they had to leave all the sledges and everything there. But there was enough sledging for anybody who wanted to go sledging, to sort of satisfy them, really.
You kind of skipped over that stranded party at Coronation Island. Was there more to it than what you said? Were there moments when you were worried about them or yourselves?
Not really, because we could see them. Through binoculars, we could see that they were there and that. But we were a bit worried about as to when we were going to get them back.
Hmm.
Because I'm not quite sure. I don't think we told Secfeeds that they were there, because they were just going over and they'd come back when they were ready.
Mm.
So I think we kept that pretty quiet until after they got back. Then we had to ring it to send a signal and say, "Look, we've got them back, but can the Shackleton go and pick all their gear up?"
Oh right, so you had to leave the dogs behind.
No. We brought the dogs back with us
in the 12-foot dinghy.
In the dinghies, yes, that was fun.
One dinghy.
No, we had a 12-foot clinker boat and a fiberglass dinghy.
Right.
And
didn't the dogs try to get out?
Well, they couldn't because we chained them down.
Right.
They were quite, I've got some photographs somewhere of them. Yeah, they seemed to enjoy it, actually. And all we were interested in was getting back as quick as possible.
Mm-hmm. There was another incident involving Coronation Island, which was a bit scarier, I believe.
The ice...
When you were with Ken Kenyon.
Oh, good Lord, yes, we were collecting eggs. Yes, we went out, we used to collect the penguin eggs for the base for the whole year. And we used to bring them back and put them down in flour. And the ideal time was when most of the penguins had got two eggs. Well, they got one and the others, and some of them got two, because they always laid two eggs, but you didn't want to get the two eggs and take the lot away, so it was best to take the one, because they always laid another one. Anyway, we went over to Coronation Island, and we're going along with the dogs, and there's a big tide crack, and suddenly these penguins popped up, and the dogs saw them, and they went straight for it. Well, we thought we'd get across, but we didn't. And we come to a grinding halt. Ken had jumped off, and I'm at the back of the sledge. The dogs are trying to pull him, but they can't get me out because I'm like that. So in the end, Ken said, well, you'll have to let them go. So I let them go, and of course I floundered around in the water. And every time I got out, the ice sort of went away, but he got a big thumper, big long rope. So he laid on the ice and eventually he pulled me out. So by this time, the dogs have disappeared and they're halfway back to base. And we did catch up with them about a mile, back to base.
Were they still chained together?
They were still in there. Yeah, they were still, all on the trace with the, they were absolutely shattered by this time. Yeah.
So how did that resolve itself? Did he get the sledge back? Did he have to manhole it back?
Well, the sledge back? No, the dogs had got the sledge.
Oh, they weren't? Okay.
Yeah, they got the sledge. Yeah, we had to walk back, didn't we? Then when we got the sledge, we were all right.
And so you're walking back to base soaking wet?
Yes. Yeah, which, fortunately, it was a calm, windless, right. Sunny day, so it wasn't, and it wasn't too... too cold either, But,
was there a lesson to be learnt from that, or was that just one of those things?
Just one of those things.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, our health and safety in those days was non-existent, really.
Well, there was common sense, I guess, wasn't there?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. But, I mean, you went out in the boat on your own, and, we used to go across the bay, which, of course, you wouldn't be allowed to now at all, and things like that.
You also used the dinghies to collect burgy bits for milk.
Oh, yes, that's right, yes.
Tell me about that.
The burgy bits used to come in and used to chop chunks off and tie them up and tow them in. And we were going across to Billy Rocks, which is just in the bay, and there's quite a reasonable-sized little berg there and a nice chunky bit. So I got the axe and I'm chunking through it. And when I got through, the burgy bit fell in the water and there's a big upheaval, and suddenly I shot up in the air in the boat and landed flat on the rock in the boat still, and the berg turned over. It was, I suppose it wasn't that big. It was probably, as high as that top of that cupboard, and not even to the ceiling. But, most of it, of course, was under the water. But it turned, and, the impact sort of washed straight up. And I was dead lucky that it landed, so that I was still upright.
So the fact you hacked a bit off destabilised
it? Destabilised it, yeah.
Gosh. One of your goon shows was overheard, wasn't it? Wasn't it overheard in the Falklands?
Oh yeah, we were on the goon show. We were onto one of the bases. I think it was Midsummer's Night. Paddy White and company, and we were all telling jokes and singing. And of course, as the booze went down, they got more raucous and more loud and. You weren't worried because nobody heard it anyway. Until the next day, we got a signal from, I don't know which island, which sheep station it was in the Falklands, and it just said, "Enjoyed your programme very much last night. Can we tune in for another one tonight?" Which was a bit embarrassing, actually.
Modified your behaviour, did it?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, the Goon Show was quite an institution, wasn't it? Particularly in the early years.
Oh, yes.
How did it work?
Well, somebody just call up and...
But all the stations were on air together, weren't they?
You had your Metzged, I think it was 8 o'clock at night, and then afterwards you tuned in and everybody chatted to everybody else, and the ships generally sort of used to... The ships used to join in when they were down. It was just sort of a bit of a free-for-all, really.
Was it a kind of concert party, or...?
No, it wasn't a goon show so much. It was just chit-chat and...
garden fence gossip.
Yes, how's old so-and-so getting on and what have you, and that type of thing. You learnt sort of various things, that you probably wouldn't have done by listening to their... normal radio programmes.
So those who wanted to sing would gather around the radio in the evening?
Yes, yeah.
Were you learning about movements of ships as well, more important stuff? Was it all just nonsense, really?
It was all more or less nonsense, because the ships, you knew where they were going, and that was all official. So you'd get, their movements anyway.
Tell me a bit more about Wink Mander, because there were two or three
things.
Wink Mander. There were two or three incidents that he was involved with, weren't there?
Oh, Wink. Oh, God. Yeah.
I'm thinking of toilets.
Toilets, yes. Well, Bolton and Poole, in their... they built the toilets at the end of the hut, next to the radio shed, shack, and opposite the kitchen. And we used to use... 14-pound flour tins, empty tins, and they built a two-holer. So you put a tin there and a tin there, and once that one was full, you take it... The idea of two holes was, once one was full, you just blocked it off and waited till it got emptied. If not, you use the one next to it. Anyway, on the Goon Show one night, we had the lads came through and they said, "Well, we got this flipping bloke on. He's been there, he's coming down so-and-so, I think, where he was going. But he'd done, knew everything and what he wasn't going to do. And he was generally, you know, quite loud and what have you. Anyway, when he came ashore, he was in our lounge. And it's a bit like you're in a house, you know, you're in your home and suddenly you're invaded by all these people. And he's let in forth. Anyway, disappears out to the toilet. Wink. Goes. So I think we'd had seal meat and dried onions the night before. So Wink goes in, opens the door. The bloke comes out. Wink sits down, farts, and starts chatting away to him.
On the two-holer.
On the two-holer. And then Wink comes out. And they said when he came back into the lounge, they'd never seen anybody quite so deflated. I think it served him well, actually, because he was all right up. You know, it really taught him a lesson.
And what about the supply of alcohol? Was Wink also involved in...
Oh, yes, yeah.
We, with alcohol?
Well, when we went down with Captain Blackburn, he was... when I came off the ship, they said you can get extra booze if you want. So it wasn't Jerry Cutland. He wasn't on the Shackleton. But when I approached the steward there, he said, oh, Captain Blackburn says we're not to give you very much. So I got a bottle of rum and a bottle of gin. A bottle of rum and a bottle of whiskey. And somebody else got a bottle of gin and something, two bottles, and that was it. Anyway, Wink comes down and he said, what's the score with the booze? And I was the Minister of Food, and I said, well, there's loads upstairs. Rum? Good Lord, I said, enough to sink a battleship. He said, well, that's all right, but we've got a long way to go. Well, we better get some more in, more stuff in. So he said, what do you want? He said, oh, no Jerry Cutland on the Bisco. So there's no problem. He said, what do you want? I said, oh, I thought, well, I only got a bottle of gin and a bottle of rum. I'll have one of each, you know, one of each. Yeah, that's fine. So we all pile on board, had a few beers and what have you. They come out. Said, right, come on in. We get up the top of the gangway, and it's absolutely chock-a-block with cases. A case of gin, a case of whiskey, a case of rum. So we piled it all on board and brought it ashore. It sounded a lot, in actual fact, but all it was, did you wanted a drink, you could have a drink.
Where did he get it from? Was the ship swamped with booze?
Well, Jerry Cutland?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he because he used to sell it on the way down, you see, to in the mess and to Peter and to the crew and that. So the more he could sell, the better, the more money he made, presumably. So he was quite happy to sell it.
There's also a story about McEwan's ale as well.
Oh, the McEwan's, yes. We decided to send back to Port Stanley for the McEwan's ale. And we expected some of the, you know, small tins or bottles. And they didn't. They came in a big case. Captain Johnson, it was.
Bill Johnson,
yeah. He came on the radio and said that he was coming in. He didn't have time to offload everything that we needed, everything, all the essentials, or all the gear that we should do, but... He would send a scow ashore with the essentials. Of course, his scow came ashore loaded with these bloody boxes of McEwan's. They were litre bottles all packed in straw and what have you.
So there's no there's no shortage of alcohol on Cygnet, yet at that time, Fids were a bit, weren't they a bit sort of careful about how much drinking you did?
Oh, yes. I think after that session, they really clamped down on it. But
you all got riotously drunk, did you?
Well, not really. Yeah, I mean, if you wanted to, you could have done.
No, at that point, when all this booze suddenly arrived, it was...
No. It was all sort of...
Regulated,
you know.
Was that your job?
Well, no, we shared it out between us, really. We just made sure that it was available if anybody wanted it.
You said you were Minister of Food. What do you mean by that?
Oh, the Minister of... yes, you were in charge of all the stores and the food, and you allocated it to the cook as to what he... it was all rationed out. But if you went by the rations, And you had to order, and you were responsible for ordering next year's as well. If you went by the rations, they were quite adequate. And previous Minister of Foods had not had say if you got something that people didn't particularly like, they still ordered the maximum amount. So you know, you had loads of food because we kept 6 months supply as well in case anything went wrong. And it worked very well.
I mean, were there problems with knowing what food was where? You had to presumably had to carefully stash it all away and have an inventory.
Oh yes, we had an inventory, and we knew the which had got to be used first and which hadn't, and we had the 6 months supply was kept in a hut down at Burdeston Point, and every year we'd swap it over and bring it in. I mean, we had some porridge oats, I think, which were down with in 1937 with the Graham Land expedition.
They were okay, were they?
Perfectly okay, yeah. And then we supplemented as well. We used to eat seal meat as well because we had to kill seals for the dogs.
Yeah.
So we had seal liver and seal meat.
Tell me about these Adelie penguins and Edinburgh Zoo. What's the story here?
Ah, we had a message from Secfid saying, requesting that we collected a dozen Adelie penguins, and we brought them back to base and kept them for the Shackleton or Biscoe to come and pick them up. And eventually they would land at end up at Edinburgh Zoo. Well, Pete Richards, this was the first summer, Pete Richards was basically, he just sent back, gone fishing. So we then got a screed back from Secfid saying that our relationship with the Edinburgh Zoo was excellent and very good, and we were obliged to try and this, that and the other.
This is Johnny Green, was it?
Yeah. It sort of rambled on a bit to the end. So then Pete sent back, I refer you to my Bird Island, my ornithological report, 1958, page so-and-so, paragraph so-and-so, which states, this. When we got this message, it was in beginning of March, and by this time all the penguins, all the Adelies had gone. Mm. Refer you to that. So then we got back, not an apologetic one, but saying, oh, well, perhaps you could get some chinstrap penguins instead, which is what we did. And I spent hours bloody catching Nautothenia, cutting it into strips, feeding these bloody penguins, which eventually, I think some of them did get back to Edinburgh Zoo.
But not all.
But not all, no.
So did you box them up in some way for the plane, for the boat, for the
well,
ship?
Well, we built cages for them for the ship. But what they did with them when they got from there back to the UK, I don't know. I assume that they must have had a supply of fish and that to keep them.
They would have had to have gone through the tropics, wouldn't they?
Yes, yes. But some of them did make it back.
Mm. There's a story about a husky pup, Bill Mitchell.
This is onto the toilet things.
Oh, is it?
Yes, well,
I didn't know that.
Once that had gone, decided that really this was a bit adjacent to the hut, this toilet, so we built a beach bog. There was all stuff from the Whalers' Plan, loads of wood about. So we built this beach bog about sort of 30 or 40 yards, and it got a flag on it. The idea was you went down, and when you went in, you lowered the flag. When you'd finished and came out, you hired the flag. But it didn't work.
Why not?
I don't know, because you get to the back door and it'd be howling gale and you'd look and the flag would be down and you think, oh, God. Then you'd go around and have a count up and everybody was back. So I used to hurtle down. So then we became sort of where we used to use the beach and used to find tide cracks and places there. And it was on one of these occasions, I'd been down, and we had husky pups running round, and they used to chase you everywhere. And they weren't averse, like a lot of dogs, to eating what was left. And of course, I'd been down, the pups had been in, came back. As I came round the corner, it's a lovely sunny day, and the slopes at the back there, and the cook of the day, which is Bill, and the window watching, round the corner race these pups, and they're licking his face. Bill, you don't really want to know where they're... Oh, dear, he's... Oh, get out!
We've been looking at this funny side of working and living Sydney at that time, but there was also the sad case of Roger Filer. Well, were you around at that time?
Yeah.
You don't have to talk if you don't want to.
Yeah, I will do. It's just I'd promised myself I wouldn't get... Yes, it was very sad.
What's your memory of that episode?
Oh, quite a lot. Wink, Bernard Harrison and Roger were on base. And we built a refuge hut over the other side of the island so that when you went over to... instead of going over every day to ban the giant petrels or work on any of the birds, you got somewhere you could go. It had got a wind jenny and a radio and a place you could stay. And Derek and I were over there banding the GPs or counting the GPs and what have you. And Wink was one of these blokes to do everything. He could do the radio as well. So he used to do the radio, and then we had a sked with him every night. And he called up and said, is Roger with you? No. Oh. And Roger had left early in the morning to go to Gurley to do some work on some sheath bills. So Derek and I sort of thought, well, this is a bit worrying. So we went out and we went up, bearing in mind it's dark, it was a moonlight night, and we went up and we called and hollered, and you could hear for miles over the ice cap and nothing. So we came back down, and we decided that the best thing to do was to get back to base, but it was dark. So we went back over a little ice cap and into Shallow Bay, and where we left the boat. We got it all got into base, by which time it's, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. And we decided also that there was nothing could be done until daylight. So as you can imagine, we had a pretty restless night. And then we went out to Gurley and we found him. And he was flat down on a rock. He's obviously, dead. So I went, they lowered me down on a rope and we managed to get him back up to the top.
Did you volunteer to go down on the rope?
I don't know who,
All right.
It was just...
You brought him back.
One of those things. But we got him back up to the top. The sea was very rough. So we knew there was no way we could get a boat round because it was a particularly rough area to get into. So we then went back to base and we got sailcloth and what have you, and we wrapped him in that and built a cairn over him, and we knocked up a cross, and that was it. And we tried to get the boats, we asked for one of the boats to come, but they weren't in the area, and it was, it would have been it just wasn't feasible. So it wasn't until the next year the Shackleton came in and the Padre came in and they actually went down and consecrated the rain. He's still there in the same place. But that was a bit traumatic, as you can imagine, because there's five of you and then suddenly there's four.
And he'd just fallen, had he?
He'd just fallen, yes.
Collecting eggs or something, wasn't he?
He was,
ringing birds.
He was banding birds. These sheathbills lived in holes at the end of, anywhere, and they were there was a flat ridge, and he was the sheath bill was at the end, and I think he was probably trying to hook it out. And Roger was one of those that had a camera on this shoulder and a pair of binoculars on there, and you know, and he probably came out and was startled and slipped, and that was it. Mm. I suppose that was another. That was probably a good thing, a reminder that you should have gone in twos. Mm. But there again, you see, it wasn't always feasible for two people to, you know, spend the time to do this.
But generally speaking, did you change the way you worked into having pairs only?
No. No, because I think, no, we didn't really. I think we were a lot more cautious. Any nest that was out of reach, that you had to climb up, and we just didn't bother about. Mm. It was just noted, and that's it. We wouldn't, anything on the edge of a cliff or round the corner where you had to scramble around you, you just didn't bother about.
Did you try to meet Roger's family when you got home?
Yes, I went down to Aberavon and met his mum and dad and his sister Anne. And of course, Derek had come. Derek came home the year before me, so he'd already been down. And then, of course, he married Anne.
Derek
Clark. He married Anne. Yes, it was very sad for the parents, you know. Very typical, they'd worked hard all their lives and got the children through to university. And
did you think they were grateful that you'd made the effort to go and see them?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes, they were, yes. Yeah, we kept in touch. In fact, we kept in touch, really, until they passed away. Anne took it very badly. Somebody said that it's only since they had this monument and that she's sort of come to terms, but she would never discuss, and we never discussed it with her either. She knew that we knew the score anyway.
I've got a couple of little stories to ask you to wind up on, if I may, Ron. Yeah. One is another Derek Gyps.
Oh.
This involves trousers, I think.
Oh, yes, that's right. Well, this is only a hearsay. apparently they were in Stanley and they used to dish out the uniforms in Stanley, and sometimes they were a bit like the army things, they were a bit big, and this chap was muttering on and on about these bloody trousers were too long and how was he going to get them. In the end, Derek Gyps said, give them to me, got them out, put them on the deck, laid them out, went and got the fire axe and went, pew, there you are, sir.
You were there when we're used to tourist ships in the Antarctic now, but you saw one or two of the first ones, didn't you?
No, we didn't see any. No, you didn't see any at all. What happened was, when you're on the radio, you can tell the transmitters, the sound of a transmitter, you knew before it only just got to send its call sign, and you knew, that's deception. This particular night, this bloody thing came up, and I thought, what the hell's that? Anyway, it was the radio op from Deception. And in the morning, he'd got a long screed from SecFids in code, which, of course, naturally we took down and decoded. And he was actually on board the tourist ship. and in having great fun, all of them.
Or baffling people.
Just enjoying himself. I don't think they left anybody on base. And anyway, when we deciphered this bloody thing, it said, under no circumstances, repeat, no circumstances, are you to go near or fraternise with any members of the tourist ship visiting your area. Too late. They were already on board. And the one at Admiralty Bay, the lads were out on their binoculars, the ship coming. So they all went in, they all changed into their best gear, and they all standing there on the, where their old jetty was, waiting, and it came in, round, waved, and went out again. Now, the only thing we got the whole time I was there was a whaling ship, well, a whaler, which brought us a ton of, not a ton, but a large chunk of whale meat and a few whales' teeth and various other bits and bobs. I don't really know why they came in. I think it was just a fly-in visit. Mm. The year after, the Russians came in, and that's when the lady came down.
The lady?
Yes, the Russian, Svetlana, I think her name was, Pete Tilbrook. Have you spoken to Pete? He must have told you about that, because I'm sure Pete was there when she was there.
Tell me your story, to finish with.
What?
Well, tell me what you saw.
Well, when I was...
With Svetlana.
Oh, I didn't see... I didn't know. I wasn't there.
Right.
No, she came afterwards. No, we had nobody. We only had this bloody whaling ship. I mean, they were lucky. They got all the...
Attractive Russians.
Yes. Yeah.
Looking back over your life then, Ron, how does the Antarctic rate...
It was an experience I enjoyed, and I wouldn't have missed it for the world. And I just think how fortunate, you know, pay £8,000 to go down there, and I wouldn't want to go down on a ship like that. It would...
Tourist ship?
Yeah, not a tourist ship, no. And it's everything's changed so much, even because I was at Bird Island, you know, with Lance Tickell for 18 months, and... it's changed out of all now.
Well, tell me a bit about Bird Island, because not many people talk about Bird Island.
Well, there again, Wink Manders was involved. I'd spoken to Lance. Lance was working on the Wandering Albatross. He wanted to work on the Giant Petrels, but he tried to get down... to talk British Antarctic Survey, as it was then. Or were they? Yes. No, they were still Falkland Island Independencies. Setting a base up. But they weren't really that interested. So he then... Bill Sladen, who began in Hope Bay years ago, was a professor at Maryland University. So Lance went over and... Bill managed to get USARP, United States Antarctic Research People, to fund Lance to go down to work on Bird Island. So, but it was all done through BASS because it had to be sorted out. They had to get permission from BASS. So Lance wanted somebody who could operate the radio, didn't mind doing a bit of concreting and all other sorts of things and bird work as well. And anyway, he came back, he went with Wink, and he tried to talk Wink. Well, Wink wasn't interested in birds anyway, and it didn't fit into his next move, so he suggested I went. Anyway, I got this note from Lance out of the blue, sort of, to go to meet at the Chandos Club in off Trafalgar Square for a bit of a do. So I went, had a bit of a do, and left. Oh, that's right. And on the way out, he said, "Oh, by the way, I'm getting married at Sutton Church tomorrow morning. Why don't you come?" So, of course, the next morning I woke up and I thought, well, I don't even really know him that well. You know, he can't just sort of turn up. And about 3 days later, I got a card from him saying, "Sorry you didn't make it to the wedding, but I meant to have a word with you on Saturday night about, Friday night about going to Bird Island as a radio op." So I contacted him and we started off and we set the whole thing up in London. We were in the same office as Bunny Fuchs, who used to come, bloody foreigners coming in here, you know, used to mutter and mumble, but he was all in good, you know, spirit. So we went down, more or less the same as FIDS. We used Andrew Lusk's and the food and the ships, and everything was just like a fizz. And we arrived on Bird Island with, I think it was 64 tons of equipment and three of us. Part of the deal that Lance had, that he would have one American. So a young lad was out of Honolulu University, but called Harry Clagg, was an entomologist. So he came down. I think it was a bit of a shock to the system. I mean, he was, 19, 20, and we were sort of, almost in our bloody 30s at this stage. And anyway, he fitted in, and we went down. We got ashore. There was a little 8x4 garden shed, Bonner's Boffy. So I slept in there, and Harry and Lance slept in a tent, and we got all the stuff, and with the help, a bloke called Bill Vaughan was a ceiling inspector then at Repricon. He came in, and we put up the main hut, three other huts, and wired them all up, and it was just like a Fidd's base, It was hard graft, I can tell you. Hard graft, but it was enjoyable. And then we did the, Lance worked on his albatrosses, the Wanderers, and I ran the greyheads and the black grouse. I used to go to their rookeries every day, So I didn't say very high, but about 300 or 400 feet every day up the hill, twice a day, and they, of course, they went all over the place. Mm. You'd just be coming home. You'd been down, and you'd probably been, banding birds, and absolutely knackered. And you'd see this bird come in, and it'd drop its things. Oh God, not another bloody Aussie! And he'd chase after it and catch it, and take the numbers and what have you. Yes. Yes, that was very interesting. That was I really enjoyed that.
And that was your last time in the Antarctic.
That was my last time.
You came home. So you actually made two journeys. One,
yes.
One to go to Sydney, then one back again.
Yes. Yeah. And met my wife in between. So she was waiting. There's another little story there. When I came, Lance and I came back. We came to Port Stanley, and then we went to Montevideo, and then we flew back. And we're flying into London, and in we go. Lance gets through the check. Oh, yes. In this room we go. Read this.
Is this customs, is it?
No.
Oh.
I think it was MI5. Okay. It said you are requested to go to this office in Whitehall tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Do not mention this to anybody. Rips it up. That's it. Now I've got my fiancée outside. And, I had quite a performance trying to convince her that it was all innocent and what have you. And when I got there, as soon as I went in, I knew. And it was all about Poland.
Oh, right.
Now, that was 6 years...
Later.
That they'd obviously kept tabs on me, because they knew exactly when I was coming back in, and they were obviously sitting there waiting for me to come back in. And they wanted information, about the goings on in the embassy, of which there was quite a lot. Working in an embassy is quite intriguing, actually, because you never know who's who.
But this was 6 years after you left the embassy in Poland.
Yes, and I was out of the RAF anyway.
Were you able? I can't ask you what you told them, but were you able to help them?
Yeah, in some respects, yes. I suppose I was, yes, yeah. But most of it was just confirming what they already knew.
Your wife must have married you because you were a man of mystery.
Yeah, she Yes, it was very difficult to explain to her exactly why I had to go to London and why I couldn't tell her, you know. Mm. I mean, when I got back, I said, look, this is the score. It was something to do with when I was in Poland and, you know, the Foreign Office wanted some confirmation, you know. But, oh, dear.
Ron, you've left your wife in the car. We've been keeping it from
you. Yeah, I'm hoping that...
she's still there.
I saw Barry Haywood and Joe down in the hall, so they told her where they were, so they might have picked her up.
It's been a real pleasure, Ron.
Yeah.
We'll leave it there. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you.